but more often it would simply pass unnoticed. According to the dictionary, aphasia was forgetfulness caused by some cerebral disorder. The doctors had immediately begun monkeying with her medication. Orison was changed to Valium, with no appreciable change for the better. Valium and Orison were tried together, but an unforeseen interaction between the two had caused her to cry steadily and monotonously until the dose wore off. A brand new drug, a combination tranquilizer and light hallucinogenic, was tried and seemed to help for a while. Then she had begun to stutter and broke out in a light rash. Currently, she was back on Orison, but she was being monitored closely in case the aphasia got worse. Reams had been written about the girl's delicate psychological condition and about what the shrinks called her basic fire conflict, a fancy way of saying that her father had told her not to, and the shop people were telling her to go ahead, all of it complicated by her guilt over the incident at the Manders farm. Rainbird bought none of it. It wasn't the drugs. It wasn't being locked up and watched constantly. It wasn't being separated from her father. She was just tough, that was all. She had made up her mind somewhere along the line that she wasn't going to cooperate, no matter what. The end. Tout fini. The psychiatrist could run around showing her ink blots until the moon was blue. The doctors could play with her medication and mutter in their beards about the difficulty of successfully drugging an 8-year-old girl. The papers could pile up, and Cap could rave on. And Charlie McGee would simply go on toughing it out. Rainbird sensed it as surely as he sensed the coming of rain this afternoon. And he admired her for it. She had the whole bunch of them chasing their tails, and if it was left up to them, they would still be chasing their tails when Thanksgiving and then Christmas rolled around. But they wouldn't chase their tails forever. And this, more than anything, worried John Rainbird. Ramadan, the safecracker, had told an amusing story about two thieves who had broken into a supermarket one Friday night when they knew a snowstorm had kept the Wells Fargo truck from arriving and taking the heavy end-of-the-week receipts to the bank. The safe was a barrel box. They tried to drill out the combination dial with no success. They had tried to peel it, but had been totally unable to bend back a corner and get a start. Finally, they had blown it. That was a total success. They blew that barrel wide open. So wide open, in fact, that all the money inside had been totally destroyed. What was left had looked like the shredded money you sometimes see in those novelty pins. "The point is," Ramadan had said in his dry and wheezing voice, "those two thieves didn't beat the safe. The whole game is beating the safe. You don't beat the safe unless you can take away what was in it in usable condition. You get my point? They overloaded it with soup. They killed the money. They were assholes, and the safe beat them." Rainbird had got the point. There were better than 60 college degrees in on this, but it still came down to safe cracking. They had tried to drill the girl's combination with their drugs. They had enough shrinks to field a softball team, and these shrinks were all doing their best to resolve the basic fire conflict. And all that particular pile of horse apples boiled down to was that they were trying to peel her from the back. Rainbird entered the small Quonset hut, took his time card from the rack, and punched in. T.B. Norton, the shift supervisor, looked up from the paperback he was reading. "No overtime for punching in early, engine."
"Yeah?"
Rainbird said.
"Yeah."
Norton stared at him challengingly, full of the grim, almost holy assurance that so often goes with petty authority. Rainbird dropped his eyes and went over to look at the bulletin board. The orderly's bowling team had won last night. Someone wanted to sell 2 good used washing machines. An official notice proclaimed that all W-1 through W-6 workers must wash hands before leaving this office.
"Looks like rain," he said over his shoulder to Norton.
"Never happen, engine," Norton said. "Why don't you blow? You're stinking the place up."
"Sure, boss," Rainbird said.
"Just clocking in."
"Well, next time, clock in when you're supposed to."
"Sure, boss," Rainbird said again, going out, sparing one glance at the sight of Norton's pink neck, the soft spot just below the jawbone.
"Would you have time to scream, boss? Would you have time to scream if I just stuck my forefinger through your throat at that spot?" just like a skewer through a piece of steak. Boss. He went back out into the muggy heat. The Thunderheads were closer now, moving slowly, bowed down with the weight of rain. It was going to be a hard storm. Thunder muttered, still distant. The house was close now. Rainbird would go around to the side entrance, what had once been the pantry, and take sea elevator down 4 levels. Today he was supposed to wash and wax all the floors in the girls' quarters. It would give him a good shot. And it wasn't that she was unwilling to talk with him. It wasn't that. It was just that she was always so damned distant. He was trying to peel the box in his own way. And if he could get her to laugh, just once, get her to laugh, to share a joke with him at the shop's expense, it would be like prying up that one vital corner. It would give him a place to set his chisel. Just that one laugh. It would make them insiders together. It would make them a committee in secret session. 2 against the house. But so far he hadn't been able to get that one laugh. And Rainbird admired her for that more than he could have said. 2. Rainbird put his ID card in the proper slot and then went down to the orderly's station to grab a cup of coffee before going on. He didn't want coffee, but it was still early. He couldn't afford to let his eagerness show. It was bad enough that Norton had noticed and commented on it. He poured himself a slug of mud from the hot plate and sat down with it. At least none of the other nerds had arrived yet. He sat down on the cracked and sprung gray sofa and drank his coffee. His blasted face, and Charlie had shown nothing but the most passing interest in that, was calm and impassive. His thoughts ran on, analyzing the situation as it now stood. The staff on this were like Ramadan's green safe crackers in the supermarket office. They were handling the girl with kid gloves now, but they weren't doing it out of any love for the girl. Sooner or later, they would decide that the kid gloves were getting them nowhere, and when they ran out of soft options, they would decide to blow the safe. When they did, Rainbird was almost sure that they would kill the money, in Ramadan's pungent phrase. Already he had seen the phrase light shock treatments in 2 of the doctor's reports, and one of the doctors had been Pinchot, who had Hochstetter's ear. He had seen a contingency report that had been couched in such stultifying jargon that it was nearly another language. Translated, what it boiled down to was a lot of strong-arm stuff. If the kid sees her dad in enough pain, she'll break. What Rainbird thought the kid might do if she saw her dad hooked up to a Delco battery and doing a fast polka with his hair on end was to go calmly back to her room, break a water glass, and eat to pieces. But you couldn't tell them that. The shop, like the FBI and CIA, had a long history of killing the money. If you can't get what you want with foreign aid, go in there with some Thompsons and Gelignite and assassinate the bastard. Put some cyanide gas in Castro's cigars. It was crazy, but you couldn't tell them that. All they could see were results, glittering and blinking like some mythical Vegas jackpot. So they killed money and stood there with a bunch of useless green scraps sifting through their fingers and wondered what the hell had happened. Now other orderlies began to drift in, joking, smacking each other on the fat part of the arm, talking about the strikes they made and the spares they converted the night before, talking about women, talking about cars, talking about getting shit-faced. The same old stuff that went on even unto the end of the world. Hallelujah. Amen. They steered clear of Rainbird. None of them liked Rainbird. He didn't bowl, and he didn't want to talk about his car, and he looked like a refugee from a Frankenstein movie. He made them nervous. If one of them had smacked him on the heavy part of the arm, Rainbird would have put him in traction. He took out a sack of Red Man, a zigzag paper, and made a quick cigarette. He sat and smoked and waited for it to be time to go down to the girls' quarters. All things taken together, he felt better, more alive than he had in years. He realized this and was grateful to the girl. In a way she would never know of, she had given him back his life for a while, the life of a man who feels things keenly and hopes for things mightily, which is to say, a man with vital concerns. It was good that she was tough. He would get to her eventually. Tough cracks and easy cracks, but no impossible cracks. He would make her do her dance for them, for whatever that was worth. When the dance was done, he would kill her and look into her eyes, hoping to catch that spark of understanding, that message, as she crossed over into whatever there was. In the meantime, he would live. He crushed his cigarette out and got up, ready to go to work. 3. The Thunderheads built up and up. By 3 o'clock, the skies over the Longmont complex were low and black. Thunder rolled more and more heavily, gaining assurance, making believers out of the people below. The groundskeepers put away their mowers. The tables on the patios of the two homes were taken in. In the stables, two hostlers tried to soothe nervous horses that shifted uneasily at each ominous thud from the skies. The storm came around 3:30. It came as suddenly as a gunslinger's draw, and with all-out fury. It started as rain, then quickly turned to hail. The wind blew from west to east, and then suddenly shifted around to exactly the opposite direction. Lightning flashed in great blue-white strokes that left the air smelling like weak gasoline. The winds began to swirl counterclockwise, and on the evening weathercasts, there was film of a small tornado that had just skirted Longmont Center and had torn the roof off a shopping center photomat in passing. The shop weathered most of the storm well. Two windows were driven in by hail, and the windstorm picked up a low picket fence surrounding a quaint little gazebo on the far side of the duck pond and threw it 60 yards. But that was the extent of the damage, except for flying branches and some ruined flower beds. More work for the groundskeeping force. The guard dogs ran between the inner and outer fences crazily at the height of the storm, but they calmed down quickly as it began to slack off. The damage was done by the electrical storm that came after the hail, rain, and wind. Parts of eastern Virginia were without power until midnight as a result of lightning strikes on the Rowan Tree and Briska power stations. The area served by the Briska station included shop headquarters. In his office, Cap Hollister looked up in annoyance as the lights went off and the solid, unobtrusive hum of the air conditioner wound down to nothing. There were perhaps 5 seconds of shadowy semi-darkness caused by the power outage and the heavy storm clouds, long enough for Cap to whisper "Goddamn" under his breath and wonder what the hell had happened to their backup electrical system. He glanced out the window and saw lightning flickering almost continuously. That evening, one of the guardhouse sentries would tell his wife that he had seen an electrical fireball that looked as big as 2 serving platters bouncing from the weakly charged outer fence to the more heavily charged inner fence and back again. Cap reached for the phone to find out about the power, and then the lights came on again. The air conditioner took up its hum, and instead of reaching for the phone, Cap reached for his pencil. Then the lights went out again. "Shit," Cap said. He threw the pencil down and picked up the phone after all, daring the lights to come on again before he had the chance to chew someone's ass. The lights declined the dare. The two graceful homes facing each other across the rolling lawns, and all of the shops complex underneath, were served by the Eastern Virginia Power Authority. But there were 2 backup systems powered by diesel generators. One system served the vital functions. The electrical fence, the computer terminals. A power failure can cost unbelievable amounts of money in terms of computer time, and the small infirmary. A second system served the lesser functions of the complex, lights, air conditioning, elevators, and all of that. The secondary system was built to cross, that is, to come in if the primary system showed signs of overloading. But the primary system would not cross if the secondary system began to overload. On August 19th, both systems overloaded. The secondary system crossed when the primary system began to overload, just as the power system architects had planned. Although, in truth, they had never planned for the primary system to overload in the first place. And as a result, the primary system operated for a full 70 seconds longer than the secondary system. Then the generators for both systems blew, one after the other, like a series of firecrackers. Only these firecrackers had cost about $80,000 each. Later, a routine inquiry had brought back the smiling and benign verdict of mechanical failure, although a more accurate conclusion would have been greed and venality. When the backup generators had been installed in 1971, a senator, privy to the acceptable low-bid figures on that little operation, as well as $16 million worth of other shop construction, had tipped his brother-in-law, who was an electrical engineering consultant. The consultant had decided he could quite handily come in under the lowest bid by cutting a corner here and there. It was only one favor in an area that lives on favors and under-the-table information, and it was notable only because it was the first link in the chain that led to the final destruction and loss of life. The backup system had been used only piecemeal in all the years since it had been constructed. In its first major test, during the storm that knocked out the Briska power station, it failed completely. By then, of course, the electrical engineering consultant had gone onward and upward. He was helping to build a multimillion-dollar beach resort at Cokey Beach on St. Thomas. The shop didn't get its power back until the Briska station came online again, which is to say, at the same time the rest of eastern Virginia got its juice back, around midnight. By then, the next links had already been forged. As a result of the storm and the blackout, something tremendous had happened to both Andy and Charlie McGee, although neither of them had the slightest idea of what had happened to the other. After 5 months of stasis, things had begun to roll onward again. 4. When the power went off, Andy McGee was watching the PTL Club on TV. The PTL stood for Praise the Lord. On one of the Virginia stations, the PTL Club seemed to run continuously, 24 hours a day. That was probably not the case, but Andy's perceptions of time had become so screwed up it was hard to tell. He had put on weight. Sometimes, more often when he was straight, he would catch a glimpse of himself in the mirror and think of Elvis Presley and the way the man had softly ballooned near the end of his life. At other times he would think of the way a tomcat that had been fixed would sometimes get fat and lazy. He wasn't fat yet, but he was getting there. In Hastings Glen, he had weighed himself on the bathroom scale in the Slumberland Motel and had come in at 162. These days he was tipping the scales at about 190. His cheeks were fuller, and he had the suggestion of a double chin and what his old high school gym teacher used to call, with utter contempt, man tits, and more than a suggestion of a gut. There was not much exercise, or much urge to exercise, while in the grip of a solid Thorazine high, and the food was very good. He did not worry about his weight when he was high, and that was most of the time. When they were ready to make some more of their fruitless tests, they would iron him out over an 18-hour period, a doctor would test his physical reactions, an EEG would be taken to make sure his brain waves were nice and sharp, and then he would be taken into a testing cubicle, which was a small white room with drilled cork paneling. They had begun, back in April, with human volunteers. They told him what to do, and told him that if he did anything overenthusiastic, like striking someone blind, for instance, that he would be made to suffer. An undertone to this threat was that he might not suffer alone. This threat struck Andy as an empty one. He didn't believe that they would really harm Charlie. She was their prize pupil. He was very much the B feature on the program. The doctor in charge of testing him was a man named Herman Pinchot. He was in his late 30s and perfectly ordinary, except for the fact that he grinned too much. Sometimes all that grinning made Andy nervous. Occasionally an older doctor named Hochstetter would drop by, but mostly it was Pinchot. Pinchot told him, as they approached the first test, that there was a table in the small testing room. On this table was a bottle of grape Kool-Aid, labeled ink, a fountain pen in a stand, a pad of notepaper, a pitcher of water, and two glasses. Pinchot told him that the volunteer would have no idea that there was anything other than ink in the ink bottle. Pinchot further told Andy that they would be grateful if he would push the volunteer into pouring himself a glass of water, then dumping a goodish quantity of the ink into it, and then quaffing the whole mess. Neat, Andy said. He himself had not been feeling so neat. He missed his Thorazine and the peace that it brought. Very neat, Pinchot said. Will you do it? Why should I? You'll get something in return, something nice. Be a good rat and you get the cheese, Andy said. Right? Pinchot shrugged and grinned. His smock was screamingly neat. It looked as if it might have been tailored by Brooks Brothers. All right, Andy said. I give up. What's my prize for making this poor sucker drink ink? Well, you can go back to taking your pills, for one thing. Suddenly, it was a little hard to swallow, and he wondered if Thorazine was addicting, and if it was, if the addiction was psychological or physiological. Tell me, Pinchot, he said. How does it feel to be a pusher? Is that a Hippocratic oath? Pinchot shrugged and grinned. You also get to go outdoors for a while, he said. I believe you've expressed an interest in that? Andy had. His quarters were nice. So nice you could sometimes almost forget they were nothing but a padded jail cell. There were three rooms plus bath. There was a color TV equipped with home box office, where a new choice of three recent films appeared each week. One of the munchkins, possibly it had been Pinchot, must have pointed out that there was no use taking away his belt and giving him only Crayolas to write with and plastic spoons to eat with. If he wanted to commit suicide, there was just no way they could stop him. If he pushed hard enough and long enough, he would simply blow his brain like an old tire. So the place had all the amenities, even extending to a microwave oven and a kitchenette. It was all done in decorator colors. There was a thick shag rug on the living room floor. The pictures were all good prints. But for all of that, a dog turd covered with frosting is not a wedding cake. It is simply a frosted dog turd, and none of the doors leading out of this tasteful little apartment had doorknobs on the inside. There were small glass loopholes scattered here and there around the apartment, the sort of loopholes you see in the doors of hotel rooms. There was even one in the bathroom, and Andy had calculated that they provided sight lines to just about any place in the apartment. TV monitoring devices was Andy's guess, and probably equipped with infrared as well, so you couldn't even jerk off in relative privacy. He wasn't claustrophobic, but he didn't like being closed up for long periods of time. It made him nervous, even with the drugs. It was a low nervousness, usually evidenced by long sighs and periods of apathy. He had indeed asked to go out. He wanted to see the sun again and green grass. Yes, he said softly to Pinchot. I have expressed an interest in going out. But he didn't get to go out. The volunteer was nervous at first, undoubtedly expecting Andy to make him stand on his head and cluck like a chicken or something equally ridiculous. He was a football fan. Andy got the man, whose name was Dick Albright, to bring him up to date on the previous season, who had made it to the playoffs and how they went, who had won the Super Bowl. Albright kindled. He spent the next 20 minutes reliving the entire season, gradually losing his nervousness. He was up to the lousy reffing that had allowed the Pats to triumph over the Dolphins in the AFC Championship game when Andy said, "Have a glass of water if you want. You must be thirsty." Albright glanced up at him. "Yeah, I am kind of thirsty. Say, am I talking too much? Is it screwing up their tests, do you think?" "No, I don't think so," Andy said. He watched Dick Albright pour himself a glass of water from the pitcher. "You want some?" Albright asked. "No, I'll pass," Andy said, and suddenly gave a hard push. "Have some ink in it, why don't you?" Albright looked up at him, then reached for the bottle of ink. He picked it up, looked at it, and put it back down again. "Put ink in it? You must be crazy." Pinchot grinned as much after the test as before, but he was not pleased. Not pleased at all. Andy was not pleased either. When he had pushed out at Albright, there had been none of that side-slipping sensation, that curious feeling of doubling that usually accompanied the push, and no headache. He had concentrated all of his will toward suggesting to Albright that putting ink in his water would be a perfectly reasonable thing to do, and Albright had made a perfectly reasonable reply, that Andy was nuts. In spite of all the pain it had caused him, he had felt a touch of panic at the thought the talent might have deserted him. "Why do you want to keep it under wraps?" Pinchot asked him. He lit a Chesterfield and grinned. "I don't understand you, Andy. What good does it do you?" "For the 10th time," Andy had replied, "I wasn't holding back. I wasn't faking. I pushed him as hard as I could. Nothing happened, that's all." He wanted his pill. He felt depressed and nervous. All the colors seemed too bright, the light too strong, voices too loud. It was better with the pills. With the pills, his useless outrage over what had happened, and his loneliness for Charlie and his worry over what might be happening to her, these things faded back and became manageable. "I'm afraid I don't believe that," Pinchot said and grinned. "Think it over, Andy. We're not asking you to make someone walk off a cliff or shoot himself in the head. I guess you didn't want that walk as badly as you thought you did.
He stood up as if to go. Listen, Andy said, unable to keep the desperation entirely out of his voice. I'd like one of those pills.
Would you? Pinchot said. Well, it might interest you to know that I'm lightening your dosage, just in case it's the thorazine that's interfering with your ability.
His grin bloomed anew. Of course, if your ability suddenly came back...
There are a couple of things you should know, Andy told him. First, the guy was nervous, expecting something. Second, he wasn't all that bright. It's a lot harder to push old people and people with low or low normal IQs. Bright people go easier.
Is that so? Pinchot said.
Yes.
Then why don't you push me into giving you a pill right now? My tested IQ is 155.
Andy had tried, with no results at all. Eventually, he had got his walk outside, and eventually they had increased the dosage of his medication again as well, after they became convinced that he really wasn't faking, that he was, in fact, trying desperately hard to use the push with no success at all. Quite independently of each other, both Andy and Dr. Pinchot began to wonder if he hadn't tipped himself over permanently in the run that had taken him and Charlie from New York to Albany County Airport to Hastings Glen, if he hadn't simply used the talent up. And both of them wondered if it wasn't some kind of psychological block. Andy himself came to believe that either the talent was really gone, or it was simply a defense mechanism. His mind refusing to use the talent because it knew it might kill him to do so. He hadn't forgotten the numb places on his cheek and neck, and the bloodshot eye. Either way, it amounted to the same thing, a big goose egg. Pinchot, his dreams of covering himself with glory as the first man to get provable empirical data on psychic mental domination, now flying away, came around less and less often. The tests had continued through May and June. First, more volunteers, and then totally unsuspecting test subjects. Using the latter was not precisely ethical, as Pinchot was the first to admit, but some of the first tests with LSD hadn't been precisely ethical either. Andy marveled that by equating these two wrongs in his mind, Pinchot seemed to come out the other side feeling that everything was okay. It didn't matter, because Andy had no success pushing any of them. A month ago, just after the 4th of July, they had begun testing him with animals. Andy protested that pushing an animal was even more impossible than trying to push a stupid person, but his protests cut zero ice with Pinchot and his team, who were really only going through the motions of a scientific investigation at this point. And so once a week, Andy found himself sitting in a room with a dog or a cat or a monkey, feeling like a character from an absurdist novel. He remembered the cab driver who had looked at a dollar bill and had seen a 500. He remembered the timid executives he had managed to tip gently in the direction of more confidence and assertiveness. Before them, in Port City, Pennsylvania, there had been the wait-off program, the classes attended mostly by lonely fat housewives with an addiction to snack and cakes, Pepsi-Cola, and anything between two slices of bread. These were things that filled up the emptiness of their lives a little. That had simply been a matter of pushing a little bit, because most of them had really wanted to lose weight. He had helped them do that. He thought also of what had happened to the two shop ramrods who had taken Charlie. He had been able to do it, but no more. It was hard even to remember exactly what it had felt like. So he sat in the room with dogs that lapped his hand and cats that purred and monkeys that moodily scratched their asses and sometimes showed their teeth in apocalyptic, fang-filled grins that were obscenely like Pinchot's grins. And of course, none of the animals did anything unusual at all. And later on, he would be taken back to his apartment with no doorknobs on the doors, and there'd be a blue pill in a white dish on the counter in the kitchenette, and in a little while he would stop feeling nervous and depressed. He would start feeling pretty much okay again, and he would watch one of the home box office movies, something with Clint Eastwood, if he could get it, or perhaps the PTL Club. It didn't bother him so much that he had lost his talent and become a superfluous person. 5. On the afternoon of the big storm, he sat watching the PTL Club. A woman with a beehive hairdo was telling the host how the power of God had cured her of Bright's disease, and he was quite fascinated with her. Her hair gleamed under the studio lighting like a varnished table leg. She looked like a time traveler from the year 1963. That was one of the fascinations the PTL club held for him, along with the shameless carny pitches for money in the name of God. Andy would listen to these pitches delivered by hard-faced young men in expensive suits and think, bemused, of how Christ had driven the money changers from the temple. And all the people on PTL looked like time travelers from 1963. The woman finished her story of how God had saved her from shaking herself to pieces. Earlier in the program, an actor who had been famous in the early 1950s had told how God had saved him from the bottle. Now the woman with the beehive hairdo began to cry, and the once famous actor embraced her. The camera dollied in for a close-up. In the background, the PTL singers began to hum. Andy shifted in his seat a little. It was almost time for his pill. In a dim sort of way, he realized that the medication was only partially responsible for the peculiar changes that had come over him in the last 5 months, changes of which his soft weight gain was only an outward sign. When the shop had taken Charlie away from him, they had knocked the one solid remaining prop out from under his life. With Charlie gone, oh, she was undoubtedly somewhere near, but she might as well have been on the moon, there seemed to be no reason for holding himself together. On top of that, all the running had induced a nervous kind of shell shock. He had lived on the tightrope for so long that when he had finally fallen off, total lethargy had been the result. In fact, he believed he had suffered a very quiet sort of nervous breakdown. If he did see Charlie, he wasn't even sure she would recognize him as the same person, and that made him sad. He had never made any effort to deceive Pinchot or cheat on the tests. He did not really think that doing so would rebound on Charlie, but he would not have taken even the most remote chance of that happening. And it was easier to do what they wanted. He had become passive. He had screamed the last of his rage on Granther's porch as he cradled his daughter with the dart sticking out of her neck. There was no more rage left in him. He had shot his wad. That was Andy McGee's mental state as he sat watching TV that August 19th while the storm walked the hills outside. The PTL host made a donations pitch and then introduced a gospel trio. The trio began to sing, and suddenly the lights went out. The TV also went, the picture dwindling down to a bright speck. Andy sat in his chair, unmoving, not sure just what had happened. His mind had just enough time to register the scary totality of the dark, and then the lights went on again. The gospel trio reappeared, singing, "I got a telephone call from heaven and Jesus was on the line." Andy heaved a sigh of relief, and then the lights went out again. He sat there, gripping the arms of the chair as if he would fly away if he let go. He kept his eyes desperately fixed on the bright speck of light from the TV, even after he knew it was gone, and he was only seeing a lingering afterimage, or wishful thinking. "It'll be back in a second or two," he told himself. "Secondary generator somewhere. You don't trust a house current to run a place like this." Still, he was scared. He suddenly found himself recalling the boys' adventure stories of his childhood. In more than one of them, there had been an incident in some cave with the lights or candles blown out. And it seemed that the author would always go to great lengths to describe the dark as palpable, or utter, or total. There was even that tried and true old standby, the living dark, as in, the living dark engulfed Tom and his friends. If all of this had been meant to impress the 9-year-old Andy McGee, it hadn't done. As far as he was concerned, if he wanted to be engulfed by the living dark, all he had to do was go into his closet and put a blanket along the crack at the bottom of the door. Dark was, after all, dark. Now he realized that he had been wrong about that. It wasn't the only thing he'd been wrong about as a kid, but it was maybe the last one to be discovered. He would just as soon have forgotten the discovery, because dark wasn't dark. He had never been in a dark like this one in his life. Except for the sensation of the chair beneath his butt and under his hands, he could have been floating in some lightless, Lovecraftian gulf between the stars. He raised one hand and floated it in front of his eyes. and although he could feel the palm lightly touching his nose, he couldn't see it. He took the hand away from his face and gripped the arm of the chair with it again. His heart had taken on a rapid and thready beat in his chest. Outside, someone called out hoarsely, "Richie, where the fuck are you?" And Andy cringed back in his chair as if he had been threatened. He licked his lips. "It'll be back on in just a second or two now," he thought. But a scared part of his mind that refused to be comforted by mere rationalities asked, "How long is a second or two, or a minute or two, in total darkness? How do you measure time in total darkness?" Outside, beyond his apartment, something fell over, and someone screamed in pain and surprise. Andy cringed back again and moaned shakily. He didn't like this. This was no good. "Well, if it takes them longer than a few minutes to fix it, to reset the breakers or whatever, they'll come and let me out. They'll have to." Even the scared part of his mind, the part that was only a short distance away from gibbering, recognized the logic of this, and he relaxed a little. After all, it was just the dark. That's all it was, just the absence of light. It wasn't as if there were monsters in the dark or anything like that. He was very thirsty. He wondered if he dared get up and go to get a bottle of ginger ale out of the fridge. He decided he could do it if he was careful. He got up, took two shuffling steps forward, and promptly barked his shin on the edge of the coffee table. He bent and rubbed it, eyes watering with pain. This was like childhood, too. They had played a game called Blind Man. He supposed all kids did. You had to try to get from one end of the house to the other with a bandana or something over your eyes. And everyone else thought it was simply the height of humor when you fell over a hassock or tripped over the riser between the dining room and the kitchen. The game could teach you a painful lesson about how little you actually remembered about the layout of your supposedly familiar house, and how much more you relied upon your eyes than your memory. And the game could make you wonder how the hell you'd live if you went blind. "But I'll be all right," Andy thought. "I'll be all right if I just take it slow and easy." He moved around the coffee table and then began to shuffle his way slowly across the open space of the living room with his hands out in front of him. It was funny how threatening open space could feel in the dark. "Probably the lights will come on right now and I can have a good laugh at myself. Just have a good Ow! His outstretched fingers struck the wall and bent back painfully. Something fell. The picture of the barn and hayfield after the style of Wyeth that hung near the kitchen door, he guessed. It swished by him, sounding ominously like a whickering sword blade in the dark, and clattered to the floor. The sound was shockingly loud. He stood still, holding his aching fingers, feeling the throb of his barked shin. He was cotton-mouthed with fear. "Hey," he shouted. "Hey, don't forget about me, you guys." He waited and listened. There was no answer. There were still sounds and voices, but they were farther away now. If they got much farther away, he would be in total silence. "Forgotten all about me," he thought, and his fright deepened. His heart was racing. He could feel cold sweat on his arms and brow, and he found himself remembering the time at Tashmore Pond when he had gone out too deep, got tired, and begun to thrash and scream, sure he was going to die. But when he put his feet down, the bottom was there, the water only nipple high. Where was the bottom now? He licked at his dry lips, but his tongue was dry too. "Hey!" he shouted at the top of his lungs, and the sound of terror in his voice terrified him even more. He had to get hold of himself. He was within arm's length of total panic now, just bulling around mindlessly in here and screaming at the top of his lungs. All because someone had blown a fuse. Oh, goddammit all, anyway. Why'd it have to happen when it was time for my pill? If I had my pill, I'd be all right. I'd be okay then. Christ, it feels like my head's full of broken glass. He stood there, breathing heavily. He'd aimed for the kitchen door, had gone off course and run into the wall. Now he felt totally disoriented and couldn't even remember if that stupid barn picture had been hung to the right or left of the doorway. He wished miserably that he had stayed in his chair. "Get hold," he muttered aloud. "Get hold." It was not just panic, he recognized that. It was the pill that was now overdue, the pill on which he had come to depend. It just wasn't fair that this had happened when his pill was due.
Get hold, he muttered again.
Ginger ale. He had got up to get ginger ale, and he was going to, by God, get it. He had to fix on something. That's all it came down to, and ginger ale would do as well as anything else. He began to move again toward the left, and promptly fell over the picture that had come off the wall. Andy screamed and went down, pinwheeling his arms wildly and fruitlessly for balance. He struck his head hard and screamed again. Now he was very frightened. Help me, he thought. Somebody help me. Bring me a candle, for Christ's sake. Something. I'm scared. He began to cry. His fumbling fingers felt thick wetness on the side of his head. Blood. And he wondered with numb terror how bad it was. Where are you people? He screamed. There was no answer. He heard, or thought he heard, a single faraway shout. And then there was silence.